The Guardian. On Saturday, 20th of July, a protest took place in London's Trafalgar Square to raise awareness of female genital mutilation and call for the UK government to draw up a national strategy and action plan to eliminate it in the UK. It's a taboo subject, and some members of the public have never even heard of the practice of cutting part or all of a young girl's outer genitalia.
It's not something that you would ever hear or see on the news, and I think that's probably why it's not as widely known. I didn't even knew it went on in the UK. I think it's terrible.
They can't talk about it because, like, someone from my country, I'm from Sierra Leone, you know, talking about the FGM, which is known as the Bondo Society, it's a taboo. And people know, they fear that something bad will happen to them. You know, so this is why they don't talk about it.
Around the world, about 140 million girls and women are living with the consequences of FGM. More than 66,000 women in the UK have already undergone FGM, and more than 20,000 girls are at risk, especially now as the summer holidays begin. In this month's Guardian Global Development podcast, I'm joined by a panel of women who are fighting to eradicate FGM in the UK and around the world. We'll be asking the difficult questions that come with dealing with a practice that dates back generations and is subject to intense secrecy. It is now recognised as a human rights violation. Can it be ended in a generation? Joining me in the studio is Nana Otuoyete, Executive Director of the NGO Forward, Nimco Ali, co-founder of Daughters of Eve, and down the line, Bogolech Gebra, known as Boge, founder and director of KMG Ethiopia. Nimco, you were cut when you were 7. How was that process explained to you and justified? Can you tell me a bit about what happened?
It wasn't essentially explained, it just happened, and it was something that was going to happen before we came back to the UK, so there was no conversation had about it. It wasn't a discussion that was had with me. So then I underwent FGM, and that was just, it was at that moment when, for me, it didn't make sense because nobody talked about it at the time, afterwards, or even since. And that's why I've been campaigning for this, for us to have a more open conversation about FGM.
So what happened? You were sort of just taken on holiday, almost?
No, we were on holiday, and then the civil war broke out in Somalia, and then it was kind of like, on the way back, then we just had the FGM happened. So it was essentially, I think it would probably happened at an early age, then, essentially might have happened if I was if the war hadn't broken out in Somalia. But
Nana, briefly, for those who don't know, what are the types of FGM, and how can that affect a woman's health?
There are 4 types of female genital mutilation, and type 1, it removes the hood of the clitoris, and type 2, basically removing the hood of the clitoris plus part of the inner lips. Type 3 requires moving both parts of the clitoris, or sometimes not, and cutting the inner lips and outer lips and putting them together and sewing it up with just a little hole left for urination and related issues. What you tend to find is that type 4 is a mix of different types, which includes stretching, which is done, or pulling, which is done in parts of Eastern and Southern Africa, cauterization, but also sometimes pricking. And so you find different types or put into type 4. In terms of the effects of female genital mutilation on women, you'll find that depending on the more severe form, you would have issues to deal with menstruation, urination, but also sexual intercourse. But more importantly, what we don't tend to seem to be addressing is the mental health related issues and trauma associated. People talk about the short term and the long term consequences of female genital mutilation. But the reality is that there are some people who will tell you that they do not have any health related problems, and others who would have a lot of severe problems. In the UK, we are finding that type 1 and type 2 tend to have a lot more psychosexual problems.
So can FGM be eradicated in a generation? Boge, you've seen significant results on your projects in Ethiopia. What do you think?
Yes, the short answer is yes. But then what are the preconditions to make that kind of a statement boldly? What precondition do exist? Where is the state of female genital mutilation around the world, particularly in Africa? And what kind of a policy framework exists nationally, as well as in meaning in the states where female genital mutilation are practiced? And what is international law of United Nations, United Nations conventions, binding laws? And currently, female genital mutilation work, basically, when it comes to women's work in general, it's left to NGOs and at best for first ladies as a petty project. But it is not given serious attention at national level. So for me to say, yes, it is possible to eliminate female genital mutilation, this is because of our experience in Ethiopia, in area of 2 million population, within literally 10 to 15 years, we have eradicated. In other words, the ownership of the program and problem has been taken by the community, and community sanctions has been in place. And today is the opposite of being cut has become kind of a shame rather than not being cut. Not being cut has been accepted as norm. So if we can make that kind of a difference in short time in a small area, but if national policy framework exists and laws are enforced and governments have taken this as a serious issue of a human rights violation of women and have given personhood for women's issue, yes, we can stop in one generation.
Nimco, what do you think? Is it possible?
I'm not really comfortable with the whole kind of analogy of eradicating FGM in a generation, because it talks about FGM as though some kind of virus. So in terms of, can we break the cycle? Can we prevent FGM happening? Yes, we can. You know, that is breaking the cycle of FGM and oppression for one generation of women. But to say to eradicate it within a generation, it's not like we're going to medicate those survivors that are already existing. And I'm still alive. So if we don't have FGM in my lifetime, there's still 140 million women that are still out there that have undergone FGM, and it's about supporting them. And also this concept of, if you take FGM away without actually challenging the gender inequalities within those populations, then again, what happens is something else replaces FGM. So essentially for me, it's about actually, can we get a utopia society? Yes, we can, but that's working through a feminist approach.
On Monday, a UNICEF report revealed falls in the practice in Kenya, Liberia, Central African Republic, Nigeria, Burkina Faso, but no real change in countries like Somalia, Senegal, Egypt or Sudan. Nana, why are some countries able to make this progress while others aren't?
That's a very interesting question, and I was really hoping that the UNICEF data would provide a lot more answers to this, because there's been quite a number of different approaches that have been made to seem to be working. There's a lot of focus on the social norms, and that if you work with communities and communities publicly declare, then they automatically sort of link up with that issue. What we're seeing is that countries that seem to have made a lot of progress are Burkina Faso, like you mentioned. In Burkina Faso, there's a whole government approach to tackling female genital mutilation, which is not led to NGOs, just like Bogolich has just mentioned. So you're seeing that the government has set up an SOS system. There is collaboration and partnership with NGOs who are part of the government-led kind of initiative. There is a law in place. Police are informed, social workers, there is a helpline. There's a collective of processes that are happening, including working with traditional leaders as well as midwives, traditional excises, etc. So people are really working towards ending the practice. You'd find that within Kenya, we've seen examples of girls taking their fathers to court on the issue. There's social work workers, you know, there's a law in place in Kenya. So we're finding that where these are in place, things seem to be moving. It's quite interesting in the situation of Liberia. I don't know whether the war situation may have also led towards some changes, but Liberia doesn't seem to have had a much intensive work, but there seems to be also a natural progression. And what we're seeing is that the more educated you are, the less likely that your daughters are going to be cut. So there are a lot of mixed pictures when it comes to female genital mutilation. And I think the lesson that we have here, you can't have one size fits all. You do need to look at whether female genital mutilation is made by decisions are made by the parents or decisions are made by the girls. You find that in places like Kenya, Tanzania, even in Liberia, where FGM is done as a rite of passage, older girls have the opportunity to make decisions. And I think if you influence these girls, you're more likely. The UNICEF study, interestingly, shows that many girls who have been cut are really daughters of women who actually oppose the practice of female genital mutilation. So even where women are saying that they oppose the practice, maybe they are not in a position to protect their daughters. But where girls have the opportunity to stop going for FGM, you see that there seems to be a shift. So I think there is a real interest in looking at different approaches. But definitely, FGM is a social norm that we need to look at. What are the drivers in different contexts?
Yeah, Nimco, I was going to ask you, I mean, what is the first step to this process?
I think it's about the empowerment of women. And I think if you look at Burkina Faso, Kenya, and in Liberia, all those countries have a strong female leaders that have kind of like, you know, had the conversation, and the gender inequalities in those societies have been, the gaps have been like, you know, narrowed. But then if you look at places like Somalia, Ethiopia, where women, Somalia, Egypt, where women essentially have just been taken back into the private sphere. So if we look at, like, you know, that we've got this country that's going to be committing $35 million in order to eradicate FGM in Africa. But then 2 months ago, we had a conference about Somalia here in the UK, and women were in evidence in that. So it's about empowering women, and it's about looking at those kind of changes. And the only things that happen in these other countries is, like, FGM is present and it's almost universal, but then at the same time, so what are the forms of gender-based violence? So if we look at the revolution in Egypt now, what's happened with the Islamic Brotherhood taking over, women have been suppressed again, and there's more sexual violence, there's some other things are going on. So I think looking at those countries where there's been great change done and where equality now has been working greatly in a comprehensive way of actually looking at FGM, I think it's kind of a fallacy to say that if you're educated, then you won't have FGM done, because my parents were educated, and I know a lot of educated people that have FGM done, and gender-based violence is common in all sectors of society, but it's about the empowerment and the breaking of that kind of, like, you know, role that women take within society.
Let's hear from one of the participants in the protest on Saturday. She has her own story to tell about FGM.
Yeah, my name is Maimuna Jao. I'm from the Gambia. My grandmom was a quarter, and my mom, she trained my mom to be a quarter, and my mom decided to choose me. They trained me how to cut. So I was happy when I was young, when I was like 8, 10, 11 years to do the training. But it comes when I was like 15, that's when I realized that no, this is not the job I should do, because that's when I stopped going to school, when I start losing friends. That's when I start again feeling the pain that the girls are having. But I don't know how to stop it, how to manage with the elders. And they will be beating me, telling me you should have a strong heart. When I have my daughter, that's when I even said no to it. Because can you imagine holding your own daughter's leg and they are cutting her? Your daughter is crying, screaming, asking for help. And it's only mom who can help a daughter. And by that time, there is nothing I can do. I just have to hold my daughter for them to cut her. And it was like horrible to me. And I said, oh my God, this is the thing I will not do.
Berge, does this story sound familiar to you at all? And how do you work with cutters?
We must struggle in create a network We have to collaborate in every sense of the word, in a practical sense, working locally to solve issues of education, issues of economic empowerment. And culture is used as an scapegoat to control women's sexuality, to control women. If you ask any man, they will tell you why this is happening. It's to control women, they tell you, frankly. So working locally, but we must work globally. United Nations must pass a resolution that is binding.
Okay, I'd like to just bring in Nana into this. I mean, this whole idea that local and international. I mean, obviously there are international announcements and statements about eliminating the practice. But on a local level, on a practical level, what's your thought? How, you know, from the protest was saying, how do you tackle things on the ground? How do you sort of address the issue of cutters and changing perceptions and ideas?
In our perspective, working on the ground requires having to address the different layers of decision makers, layers of players at the community level, but also working at the national level in terms of getting the enabling policy framework. In the UK, there's been very, very patchy and ad hoc approaches to tackling female genital mutilation. And you'll find that quite a lot of the guidance, etc., that's in place is very much non-statutory. So it doesn't really bind, it doesn't really compel professionals to actually engage on the issues. There isn't even any rolled out training to enable key players to be able to understand and work on the issues. When you come to the community level, you find that a lot of the community work, again, is very much led by NGOs, very little funding, very much ad hoc, one-year related funding, so you can't really have a lot of sustainable programs. What we are finding in the UK is that community women are very much interested in talking about the issues. But when you want to work with communities, you actually have to enable communities to have a voice. We've been working with a women's health and leadership approach to enable women to be leaders, because the decisions are made by women, even though you find that men also make decisions in some cases. It's very important to work with young people in schools, young people as advocates for change. We're finding it very, very difficult entering in some schools. But in some schools, it's actually much easier because the schools invite you. We find girls who are very energized and engaged and want to work as advocates. However, you find that in that case, you do need to have staff informed and skilled to be able to work with young people. And I think working at this level is actually the way in which we should go forward. But we cannot go forward without having an enabling policy framework.
So Nimco, I mean, is this a question of how we're framing the FGM discussion? I mean, is this a cultural issue, a child abuse issue, or a human rights issue? I mean, is this a problem?
It's really interesting because the protest on Saturday for us was we titled it as a very British issue, and it is a very British issue, and there's two C's I don't really like to hear when it comes to the issue of FGM is community and culture. And the fact that I don't belong to any community, I belong to what I self-identify as an individual. And to keep looking at something as though there's this homogenous reason why FGM happens, that's why it hasn't been eradicated. And for us, it's about mainstreaming FGM and getting everybody to take responsibility for it. And it is that there are organisations that are doing this with little funding or no funding as we have been for the last 3.5 years. But within the last 18 months, we've got the NSP PCC to join, and we've got an NSPCC helpline. We've had FGM on the agenda. We're getting young people to actually speak about FGM, but without talking to them about FGM, but actually educate them about patriarchy and gender-based violence. And that's what we need to do. And we need to allow young people, and especially women, young women, to join the dots and actually understand that we all face different forms of oppression. And FGM is just what certain women in these communities or cultures, if you want us to use those words, face, but they're just girls like any other. And one of the things that I keep, which really offends me, is it's the constant othering of these young women. So when we use words like culture and community, then we other these children in different places. And then we talk about FGM being child abuse, but yet we circumstance their experience by calling it cutting and then by showing their images on TV and online. So it's about actually asking yourself, if we want FGM to stop,
then we have to understand it for what it is, and we have to stop circumstancing the experience of other women. Somebody that was working in Africa, one of these NGOs that are not necessarily the NGOs of, it's not the country, it's not a woman that's been through FGM herself, it's not a woman that's from Africa, a woman that's grown up in Africa, came to me and started telling me about my experience. And it's that kind of offensive behaviour which actually shuts girls down, and then that means that she won't come forward and we won't break the cycle because she starts accepting FGM as something that's identifiable to her. So like the cutter you had on your piece now, we have to have a conversation with those people, whether they're coerced into the issue or whether they're actually complicit in the whole kind of issue.
And what about prosecution? Does that have an impact at all?
An FGM prosecution is not going to eradicate FGM. What it's going to do is going to gain justice for the individual. And I think that's the difference that we have to make. That's the kind of one of the things that we have to be clear about. And then also the reason why we haven't had a prosecution is because we're putting the onus on young children to actually come forward. So we're talking about working with cutters, but that's in Africa. Here in the UK, we need to be working with teachers and social workers to actually take the onus of coming forward. Unless we're trying to prevent FGM, then we won't actually get a conviction. So rather than waiting for this smoking gun to come along and, like, you know, a young person to walk into a police station and say, so I myself, as a 7-year-old, wasn't going to come into a police station and say, FGM happened to me, because you're talking about community and culture, so nobody's having that conversation with me. But if the conversation's been had with teachers, and teachers have a duty to report, which in places like Holland and France they do, then we will get a conviction. Then we will also do the ultimate thing, which is prevent FGM and achieve that eradicating FGM in a generation, which is, but for that girl, you eradicate it within her generation, within her lifetime. So it's about ourselves asking the question, why are we putting FGM in this cultural cul-de-sac and not putting it into the mainstream agenda?
And Nana, what do you think about prosecutions? Is that the way forward?
The reality is that you can't have just one approach in terms of prosecution. France has had so many prosecutions, and yet still FGM is still happening. So you'll find that prosecution should be one part. I mean, we know some women from the community are telling you that the reality in the UK is that the law is lame-led because there hasn't been any prosecution. But what we feel is that you can't just go on prosecuting everybody, because you can't solve a cultural, and whether we like it or not, FGM is a social norm. It's a social norm because communities practice it, because everybody expects the communities to practice. Without having to break that cycle, it becomes a kind of very difficult thing to break. It's similar to other forms of you know, honor-based violence. Honor-based violence works also in the same basis, because they expect people to toe the line. They expect people to ensure the honor of the family. And because honor is so central, if you don't break that cycle to let people realize that honor can be something different, you tend to perpetuate that practice. So we do need to require that working with communities is central, but it's also part of the package. Working with key players, enabling statutory agencies to really understand their duty. Because what we tend to find, I mean, with Forward, we're hearing very often we get calls from statutory agencies who are telling us, I've got a girl, I don't know what to do. Now, I don't need to teach statutory agencies and tell them each time what's supposed to be done. It is the duty of government. We need people to be comfortable with experiencing FGM, response to FGM. But more importantly for me, we find that in the UK, unfortunately, we are not only having one group practicing, we're having different groups who are doing it for different reasons. So when you come to Europe, tackling female genital mutilation is slightly different from what's happening in other African countries, because you'd find that you'd find one ethnic group or one community really practicing, which is totally different. So I think we really need to be quite clever and see how we can address it in a much more comprehensive way. We have to work across the board at different levels and ensure that everybody has a voice in making this issue, I would say, history. And that's what we really need to be part of.
No, I wanted to come in and say that there is no such thing as honour. And this is the thing about the othering of these girls just because they're of a different colour. It's the fact that the same form of abuse that happens within a South Asian family happens within a Caucasian family. But within a Caucasian family, we call it domestic abuse, we call it rape, we call it violence. But then in order just to explain it, because we feel uncomfortable in the West, we call it honour. There is no honour with the blood of your daughters on your hands. And there is no specific reason why these men do it other than their ego and the fact that it's patriarchy that's allowing them to do it. So, for example, why
FGM happens, I have a two-year-old niece that was at the protest on Saturday, and fundamentally what she has is she's free and fearless. She will grow up to a woman that demands her rights, and that's what FGM wants to stop. It's to give you fear so you don't go and demand your rights, and therefore you take and you toe the line with what patriarchy seeks for you to do. What FGM essentially does is to break you as a woman, as a child, as a female born, and then rebuild you within their narrative. And that is fundamentally the only thing. I do agree with Nana in saying that there cannot only be one form of approach, like, you know, that prosecutions are not going to do anything, but we need to look at it like any other form of gender-based violence. So we have legislation against rape, but we know how hard it is for women to come forward. So we need to make it easier for young women to actually get the support and actually be supported. But let's not ourselves as organisations other those girls by calling them, saying, like, you know, it's a fact that it's culture, it's honour and so on. Daughters of Eve, we've had, because we've put no race or colour or anything on our organisation, we've had Caucasian girls come forward who've had FGM and never had a word to put to it because they were always told this was an African issue. But wherever women are not supported or protected, FGM can happen.
Berge, would you like to come in there?
One thing I don't agree with this kind of norm, the term norm. Female genital mutilation and violation against women's rights is not a norm. Norm to me is to not use your hand to clean your nose. Things are that are norm. Norm are that are accepted. Female genital mutilation is a violence against women's rights. It should be approached as a human rights violation, but because it's a human rights, it cannot automatically be enforced. We have to create a mechanism of harmonization of culture and norms. But when we say female genital mutilation will disappear because it is norm, is because my next neighbor who does, I will stop. That is minimizing what is happening to women.
Thank you. And the last point, I'd like to just hand over to Nimco for the last point.
No, I just wanted to say, coming back to the whole thinking globally, acting locally in a UK perspective, we have to be clear that the dynamics don't work the same as in Africa. And we do live in a society where we have legislation and we have people with different onuses. If any young women and children are listening out there, and also if any individual that knows anybody that it could be subjected to FGM, I think it's a call upon you as a human being to come forward, and hopefully you'll put up the NSPCC helpline number where they can call up and get that support.
Well, that's all for this week's Guardian Global Development podcast. For more ongoing coverage of FGM and other development issues, visit guardian.co.uk/globaldevelopment. My thanks to Nana, Nimco and Boge. I'm Liz Ford and the producer was Vivian Perry.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.